Are we there yet? Many of you with kids or have been that kid who's asked that question on long trips, you know it's kind of a cliche, classic about taking trips with your family. Are we there yet? Some of you are asking that about this study in Genesis. Are we there yet? And it's not just are we at the end yet? It's are we to chapter 38 yet? And some of you got really nervous when we fast-forwarded a little bit today, but we'll be there next week, and it will be kind of G-rated, probably PG-rated, maybe PG-13-rated, but you're used to that by now in Genesis. But we are moving toward the end, and the issue for us as we think about the book of Genesis is not just are we to the end yet? Because if we know our Bibles, we know there's another book that completes the story of Genesis. The question we're asking today is, are we in Exodus? Are we in Egypt yet? Have we made it to Egypt yet? And why is that the question before us? If we remember, that is a part of the promise that God gave Abraham. It wasn't just that he would be blessed, that he would have many offspring, that he would be given the land, and that all the nations would be blessed through him. That is the heart of the promise. But before we get to those things, and those things are consummated, God told him that his people would be in bondage by another people. And we know that's in Egypt. And we will not finish the book of Genesis until we get to Egypt. And that's why when we get to verse 1 of chapter 37, we realize we're not at the end yet. Jacob doesn't have everything that God has promised, even though he has offspring, many offspring, even though he is greatly blessed, and even though he is in the land, we are to remember there's still some tension here because we still haven't gone to Egypt. Notice verse 1 of chapter 37. We're just going to move through this chapter and then make 3 points of application at the end. But notice verse 1 of 37. Jacob lived in the land of his father's sojourning, in the land of Canaan. But he's still a sojourner. This isn't his home, per se. The Canaanites are still there, even though he is camping out just like Abraham, just like Isaac in this land. And as we think about the promise, there's still some tension here. We still have to go to Egypt. But how do we get there? Notice verse 2. We see Joseph, a preferred tattletale. Verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob. This is the 10th time we've seen that phrase throughout Genesis. God is telling this story through different men. Then he is explaining these are their descendants, and this is how God is fulfilling his promises through his promised seed, specifically Abraham, Isaac, and now Jacob and his generations. But notice, the text says, Joseph. Why does he start here with Joseph? As I said in chapter 35, there's a summary of all of his descendants. But to tell the story of Egypt, we start with Joseph. Now, why is that? This is Rachel's firstborn son. This is not necessarily Jacob's firstborn son. Remember, that is Reuben. And remember, Leah is the one who gave him his firstborn son. And so why would we not start there? Well, remember Jacob's problem? He loves Rachel more. And the Bible is just frank about that. He loves Rachel more. And so we begin to see some problems here with Jacob and his treatment of Joseph. But we've also seen in the past chapters that Reuben, Simeon, Levi, they've all sin somewhat disqualified themselves. Reuben, who sleeps with one of Jacob's concubines. And then Simeon and Levi, who have massacred a whole city. But then there's Judah. Why would we not just go to Judah? Why would we be talking about Joseph? And even more, the text continues, being 17 years old. He is the youngest. Benjamin at this time is still a toddler, but he is the youngest probably of the grown men here. But it's still out of order. Why is God telling the story this way? And it's what we've seen in Genesis to be reminded, he's the one telling the story. And he tells the story how he wants to tell the story. And so often, the youngest are the ones who are chosen for the inheritance. But notice what Joseph is doing. He's pasturing the flock with his brothers. This word brother is used 15 times in this chapter. And it's ironic that it's used because that's where the conflict, that's where the violence will come from. Brothers. But notice again, he was a boy. So we have a 17-year-old shepherd boy, which is another theme we see in Scripture, which is to remind us when we see that again in the Bible, God is telling the story. And notice the text continues with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. This is his father's wives, but these, again, are Rachel's servants. These are his half-brothers who he's out working with. And notice what Joseph does. He brought a bad report. Now, a lot of times we look at the Scriptures, especially with Joseph. We make him and Daniel these almost nearly sinless characters. And we do that because the way we want to read our Bibles. I need to be like Joseph. I need to be like Daniel. Here, Joseph is sinning. And why is he sinning? Because he is a sinner. And ultimately, the hero we need is Jesus, not Joseph. So he brings slander against his brothers. He is a tattletale. And who knows what's going on out in the field? Maybe they're being lazy. He brings this bad report to his father. And then, notice verse 3, now Israel, this is Jacob, whose name has been changed, loved Joseph more than any of his sons because he was the son of his old age. Again, the tension and conflict just mounts. We're talking about Joseph. He is the youngest. He should not be getting this preferential treatment from Joseph, as we'll see. And notice, Joseph loves him most. And it says, because he was the son of his old age. What does that mean? Well, he's Rachel's boy. He's Rachel's son. And there were many years, remember, that Rachel was waiting for a child. And then finally, God blessed her with Joseph. And so he waited so long for Joseph. And here he is. This is his son. And he prefers him more than any of his other sons. Notice what he does. He made a robe of many colors. Now, there's a lot of opinions about what this robe looked like. What we should just know about this robe is it was a really nice robe that designated Joseph with more authority than the rest of his brothers. And so he's the youngest. He's Rachel's son. He's not the firstborn. And Jacob just gives him preferential treatment and then designs this robe for him. He's walking around the pasture like he is the man. This young shepherd boy who's been given authority by his father. And we should know in reading the book of Genesis, this doesn't work out well. This sort of favoritism over and over. We've seen that in Jacob's own life. It doesn't turn out well. Verse 4, when the brothers saw their father loved him more than all his brothers, notice, Scripture doesn't mince words, they hated him. Weren't just annoyed by him or frustrated. They loathed his presence, and it says they could not speak peacefully to him. They could not talk to him. They could not stand the sight of him. This doesn't turn out well. But we see the preferred tattletale. And then we see the prideful dreamer. Notice verse 5. Now Joseph had a dream. And when he told his brothers, notice again, they hated him even more. They hate him because he's preferred. He's a little jerk, tattletale, daddy's boy. And now what's he going to do? Just be kind? Hey, guys, it's not my fault. No. He kind of rubs it in. And he has these dreams. Probably revelation from God, we would say. And notice he goes to his brothers and said, hear this dream that I have dreamed. And so instead of just keeping this to himself, he kind of rubs it in their face. I'm already preferred. I already have more authority than you. And now even God himself has told me something. The tattletale brags. Verse 7. He says, behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. And behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. And so my harvest is better than your harvest. And all of our harvest was out in a field, and your harvest began to worship my harvest. This is the revelation that I've got from God. Now we'll see in the book as they make their way to Egypt that this is a revelation of what will happen there. Remember the people of God? There is famine in the land, and where do they have to go? To a place of harvest. And who provides for them there? Who will they have to bow for there before there? Who will Joseph's brothers have to come to for help? Him, Joseph. But here he's just rubbing it in. And his brother said to him, verse 8, are you indeed to rule and reign over us? And notice again, the text reminds us, they hated him. Again, it just mounts. This is the third time. Notice, for his dreams and for his words. It's one thing, Joseph, to have revelation from God. It's another thing to rub it in our face that you're going to reign over us. You little 17-year-old shepherd boy twit. And they resent him. Verse 9. Then he dreamed another dream, and they told it to their brothers, and they said, and he said, behold, I have another dream. And can you imagine? I'm tired of hearing about your dreams. And now you've got another one. Your last dream was extremely offensive, exalting yourself over us through these animated sheaves. And now, notice what he begins to talk about. Behold, the sun and moon and 11 stars. So not only are you king of the harvest, now you're king of the cosmic orders. And notice what happens. These things were bowing down to me. And the mention of 11 here points out to the brothers, I'm talking about you. Jacob's the sun, Rachel's the moon, you're the stars, and my whole family has to bow down before me. But when he told it to his father and his brothers, notice, his father rebuked him. Now you're probably thinking, why? This is his boy whom he loves. But remember also Jacob's problem? He likes power. And he likes to be the one in charge. And now Joseph has gotten too big for his britches. And he's talking about ruling over Jacob himself. And Jacob says, shall I and your mother, the sun and moon, shall we and your brothers, the stars, indeed come and bow ourselves to the ground before you? And his brothers were jealous of him. But his father kept this saying in mind. It perturbs him. He rebukes him. And he says, you better watch what you're doing. This isn't going to end well for you. But Jacob keeps this in mind, because this is his preferred son. Then notice what Jacob does in verse 12. He sends Joseph on a dangerous mission. Notice verse 12. Now his brothers went to pasture in their father's flock near Shechem. This was the place of massacre. And so these people are not going to be kind to Jacob's family. This would have been 50 miles north. And notice verse 13. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to them, "Here I am." And so here, this language here refers to mission. We see it with Isaiah. We see it with the prophets. "Here I am. I have a mission for you, and it is to go and check on your brothers in Shechem, this dangerous place of massacre." And notice verse 14. And he said to him, "Go now and see if it is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem, this dangerous place, and now he's been sent to brothers who do not like him. And notice what happens, verse 14. And a man found him wandering in the fields. And so we think, oh, he didn't find them. All of a sudden, the narrative changes. He's on a mission, and now he's just wandering in a field out in Shechem. And it seems sort of random. It seems aimless. And this man, who we don't know who this is, asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers. Tell me, please, where they are pasturing." And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" Now, this isn't just like walking around downtown New York City and you overhear a group of shepherds who are just talking about where they're going next. This is a massive field. This is out in the country. But this man just so happens at some point to hear they are headed to Dothan, which is 15 more miles away. And we see Joseph is moving from his father and even further away from his father, as we'll see eventually in Egypt. Notice, so Joseph went after his brothers and he found them at Dothan. In verse 18, they saw him from afar. How did they see him from afar? Because of his glorious robe, his robe of authority, his prestigious robe. They see him, and what happens? "We thought we got away from this jerk. And now he's out here in Dothan checking on us." And notice they've had enough even with the sight of him. And they conspired to kill him. They hate him. They hate him. They hate him. They're jealous of him. And now they're planning to kill him. And they said to one another, "Here comes the dreamer. Here comes the dreamer." This is mocking. This is resentment. Verse 20, "Come now, let us kill him." Hatred is at its peak. "And throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say, 'A fierce animal devoured him.' And we will see what will become of his dreams." Notice, it is his dreams, his declaration of authority, that has angered them and made them jealous. And now they want to wipe out this plan, this revelation. They want to wipe out his authority. They want to kill him and hide the body. And notice, as we've seen with Jacob, they want to deceive. But notice verse 21, when Reuben, the older brother, and this is what he should do, he heard it. He rescued him out of their hands. Later, Joseph will tell us there is a struggle going on here. Reuben steps in, rightful older brother, tries to make peace, but notice how he makes peace. "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." This is what Reuben wanted to do, come back later and rescue him. Now notice, Reuben is trying in some sense to step in and establish peace. But even behind the scenes, he's acting like his father Jacob. They're all deceitful. Even in doing this good thing, he is deceitful. Because what does he want to do? He wants to get in good with Jacob. And if I can go back and tell our father that I rescued Joseph from a pit, our other brothers, that is only going to end well for me. Notice, the text continues, so when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe. This is the symbol of all of their resentment and hatred, this authority that he possesses, this favoritism, this robe of many colors. And they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. These pits were just dug out in the middle of nowhere as folks cared for their flocks or their harvest. And here, there's no water, and it's the perfect place. Just an empty pit out in the middle of nowhere. Seems random. Verse 25. Then they sat down to eat. Hey, guys, can you believe what we just did? They bound their brother and threw him into a pit. Hey, it's time for lunch. Just callous. There's no angst or anxiety over what is going on here. Let's eat. And notice, and they looked up and they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, myrrh on their way to carry it to Egypt, sort of gypsies who are going there to sell their stuff, to make money. As we'll see, there's famine in the land. They're going to Egypt to make money. And this just sort of happens. This caravan is just comes up out of nowhere. Verse 26, then Judah's downfall begins here. He said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Y'all know we can make some money here. Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not let our hand be upon him. For he is our brother, our own flesh. Notice, it seems good. This is our brother, guys. Let's not kill him. Let's just sell him. Don't you love him? Flesh and blood? Why would we kill him? Why would we let him die? We can make some money. Ishmaelites who need money in Egypt. We can sell him to him, and then they can sell him in Egypt. Notice, and his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by. This is just another sort of subgroup of this caravan of people. They drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Notice verse 29. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, the boy is gone, and I, where shall I go? This was not the way it was supposed to happen. And so they seem to have sold Joseph behind his back. And so now, what are we going to do? They took Joseph's robe and they slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in blood. Then they sent the robe of many colors, they can't even go themselves, and brought it to their father and said, this we have found. Again, lies and deceit, and everybody's vying for their role, for authority. You have Reuben, you have Judah. And notice they are deceiving their father the same way he deceived his father with a goat. Notice they sent the robe of many colors to their father and said they had found it and they want to identify whether this is your son's robe or not. And notice he identified it. Of course I identified it. I made it just for him. It is my son's robe. And it says a fierce animal has devoured him. This is the logical conclusion for Jacob. It is Joseph without a doubt that has been torn to pieces. The father is deceived by all of the sons who are vying for power, and now his preferred son is, in his mind, dead. And so how does he respond? He tore his garments, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. No, shall I go to Sheol to my son mourning? Thus his father wept for him. This is a picture of despair. And Joseph symbolically is taking on these things to say, I have been absolutely destroyed. That which I love the most is gone. What am I going to do, he says here, except die? There is nothing left for me to do except die. And we should feel his pain and agony here because there's something else coming at the end of this story that is all the more glorious. Verse 36, meanwhile, the Midianites sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. So, are we there yet? We're getting there. Joseph is now in Egypt. And what are we to make of that? Through all of this here, what are we to make of it? That God is still going to do everything he absolutely says he's going to do. He's going to do everything for Abraham that he promised to do. And he's going to carry out his plan in the exact way that he said he would carry it out. His people will go to Egypt and they will be afflicted, we see in Genesis 15, for 400 years exactly. And we begin to see how that plan is unfolding here. How will God's people get to Egypt? Favoritism, jealousy, violence, deception, betrayal. Just like every other story is told in Genesis. It's not a pretty picture. But we read this, and from our vantage point, this is meaningless and frustrating. And it's kind of like life, right? Life is full of all of these hard things: conflict, resentment, betrayal, deception, hurt, pain, violence, jealousy, favoritism. This is where we live. And so the question for you, where's it all headed? Because if it's not headed somewhere, it's all meaningless and it's hopeless. But what we are seeing here is it is God's plan that is unfolding. We're able to look through all of this and see God has said this will happen. And it is unfolding the way that he said it would happen. And so that gives us hope. That gives us joy as we see the things before us unfold. And we can say with Joseph, even when our dreams become nightmares, God's plan is still moving forward. It's not meaningless. God is still doing what he would said he would do. But Joseph's story fits in another plan of God. A greater, more glorious plan. The plan. What is God's ultimate plan for human history? What is it? That every molecule, every second, and every person would ultimately be summed up in the rule and reign of Jesus forever. That he would rule over everything that you see and you don't see. And that people from every tribe, every tongue, nation would come and bow down and serve him, not Joseph ultimately, but Jesus. Joseph points us to Jesus. We see that at the end of our Bibles. Revelation, it is Jesus' kingdom that all peoples are serving in. Paul tells us that in Colossians chapter 1, that everything was made by, for, and to, and everything comes from Jesus to display what? His supremacy in all things. That is God's plan. And that is the ultimate plan that is always unfolding. Where we get messed up is where we take our plans and other plans and we evaluate the world and history by those plans. And when those plans don't go as we plan or think, then it's a failure. God's plan won't fail. And we have to remember, even when we see our dreams and goals and plans in a trash heap, God's plan is still moving forward. When we're in a pit, God's plan is still moving forward. And so, first point of application, you can absolutely trust and believe God's plan continues to move forward. By faith, you look at the world and you're always saying, God's plans and purposes for Jesus are always unfolding. One of the problems we have in our current cultural context is that we are always distracted by the most outrageous, catastrophic news event. Every 3 seconds, we get a new one. Every time we refresh the feed, every time we look and open up the device or turn on the news, there is the next catastrophic, most outrageous thing that is happening right now. And we see the whole world at once and all the horrible things at once, all the time. And one of the problems is we're not meant to see that all of the time because we're not God. And we have absolutely no control over it. And that is why we are so miserable all the time. Because we are seeing things that are evoking emotions from us that we can do nothing about. And we live in despair. You're not going to turn the news on tonight and it's all of a sudden going to be sunshine and roses. It's not. It's going to continue to look bleak, like nightmares on your screen. It's just like, I'm not meant to see everything that you do all the time. It's one of the reasons I deleted social media. It's not good for your pastor to know everything you're doing all the time. That created more anxiety and despair in my life than anything. Been a new man since I did that. Just try it. Even my kids, Life 360. Oh, this is great. I'm gonna know where they are all the time. As soon as they leave the house, I delete, when they move out, delete it. I don't want to know what you're doing now. I'm not meant to. I can't handle it. We can't handle it. No, what we are supposed to do is find our lane over here as finite humans who are created to trust God. And every second we can say, His plan's unfolding. I don't know, but a smidgen of things that are even happening in my own life. But I know God's plan is unfolding because He said Jesus will rule and reign. We begin to see this in the story of Joseph. His plan moves forward. And so what do? Well, you latch your life to God's will for your life. What is God's will for your life? A lot of times, we get paralyzed with that question because we think about it in very abstract terms and, again, things that we have no control over. We worry about who we're going to marry, what career we're going to have, things that are 5 and 10 years down the road. And we give ourselves over to those things that, again, we don't have much control over except we are supposed to do this. Be conformed into the image of Christ. And then all of those other things begin to take care of themselves. With each step you take, you're just supposed to take the next step in trust and obedience for God. Now, you are to plan and have wisdom, but you're not to be paralyzed by those things. You're to be faithful with the next step. So many of us are depressed about our past. Some of you here today, you're thinking, I've wasted my life. I wasn't supposed to be here with this career, in this house, with this family. I thought it would be totally different. I thought I would have that degree by now. I thought I would have that promotion by now. And you feel like you've gone down the wrong path. You feel like you're meandering out in the field. And yet you're exactly where God wants you to be. It's not random. You're to focus on the next step and trust Him. And we see that with Joseph all the way through this story. Whether he is out in the field where he has obeyed his father, or he is in the pit, or he is in Egypt, what is he going to do? He is going to obey God because he trusts God. He's going to take the next step in obedience. And if you would just focus, God's taking care of the macro, the big cosmic stuff. You can't control it. You take care of the micro in your life, trusting him and doing the next right thing. What is it for you? For some of you, it's just forgiving somebody, loving somebody, leading in your home. A lot of men I know are consumed with what's going on outside of their home, and it's like a video game. And they're outraged about all these things that are out there they have no control over, when God has called you to just love your wife, parent your kids, share the gospel with people at work, and focus on these things. This is what God has called you to do. And obey him, and those other things will begin to take care of themselves. I've done enough funerals as a pastor to know this. It's not the people who have so many letters next to their name and who have accomplished so much who make the greatest impacts. It's senior adult ladies who are on a fixed income who just give for the sake of the gospel here and around the world, who make baked beans for their churches, potlucks. And they show up week after week after week, and they love in the name of Jesus, and they get to the end, and they don't even see it. You stand up at their funeral, and the place is full of stories of their impact. You can't take care of the big macro things, but you can love and serve others in the name of Jesus well. This is what God has called you to do. And finally, we are to trust God's plan is moving forward. We are to give ourselves to his will for our life. Just take the next step. And then we are to know this. When obedience leads to the pit of suffering, it isn't meaningless. I wondered if I should go ahead and tell you the end of the story today. Because without the end of the story, this does feel meaningless. That's why we read verse 20 of chapter 50 to begin our time together, because all of these other details are moving there. As for you, you meant it for evil against me. Joseph will eventually tell his brothers, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. We're to think about that as Joseph is in the pit. Why? Because you will be in the pit. And you've got to believe that this will turn for good one day. And there will be hundreds, if not thousands, millions of ways God will use the situation you're in right now to give life to other people one day, if you cling to the gospel and if you trust Christ. More than anything, it's not the people here today that say, my life's great, my life's sunshine and roses and everything's perfect that God normally uses. It's the people who right now are like, I don't know how I'm going to get up tomorrow morning. And they cling to the gospel another day. They take that next step another day. They take it again and again and again, and they trust God and by faith. And ultimately, God uses those beautiful days of suffering for his glory that you don't think are very beautiful right now. God uses it. Reality here is what Joseph will tell us is what his brother's doing is pure evil. But even in that moment, what God is doing is all good. Their betrayal will land him in Egypt, and in Egypt he will eventually take care of them. Get that? God will use their evil eventually for their provision. That's mind-blowing. That's the wisdom of God. That's why it's good we're not God, because we wouldn't map the story that way. We'd have good guys and bad guys, and it would just all make sense. And yet God's wisdom is so mind-blowing. Behind the scenes, he's using every bit of it. And notice he's using every bit of it for our good. How do we know that? At the cross, the greatest good was achieved through the worst ever evil. At the cross, what was meant for evil, pure evil, as the sinless, innocent Son of God hangs for sin under the wrath of God, condemned for sin, ultimately is used for your good. The worst evil achieves your greatest good. We see that. We see that in the story of Joseph. We see the cross. The father sends the beloved son on a mission to brothers who reject him. John 7, verse 5 says, even his brothers did not believe in him. But what did they do? What did the religious leaders do? The Jews, his brothers, they took counsel against him to put him to death, probably over lunch. And then what happened? It wasn't 20 pieces of silver, but it was 30. He was betrayed by his brothers. And then he was mocked as a dreamer. Jesus, the greater than Joseph, in a scarlet robe, a crown of thorns pressed into his head, and a little stick given to him for a scepter. And he was mocked. He was humiliated. Here comes the dreamer. Hell, king of the Jews. And then they ripped the robe off of him and took him to be crucified. But there wasn't a scapegoat for him, because it was his blood that was shed. And he was tossed into a pit. And it was his blood at that time, not the blood of a goat, that was presented to his father for your sin. Your brother, who you betrayed. See, the reality is you are the brothers. I am the brothers. How's that? We reject his authority as king. We don't want him to be king, even though he is the only one who rightfully should be king. We are the brothers who reject the father's chosen son. But here is the good news. Not even your personal sin against God can overwhelm the good he has for you. And the cross shows that. The cross is the height of your sin. It cost the Son of God his life. The wrath of God had to be poured out upon him. And so you think of your personal sin. Some of you here today, that is your issue. You're saying, how can this evil be turned to good? How can it be turned to good? You don't know the things that I've done. You don't know the thoughts that I've had. You don't know where I've been. How could this evil be turned to good? Place of massacre, Golgotha, covered in the blood of Christ when you believe in him. And it's not your good that you get. It's his good. Because what happens is he takes your evil, puts it on the Son. The Son is judged, and it is turned to his good that is then given to you by faith. And so even when you personally turn your dreams to nightmares, God's goodness for you is still at work.